Was it not? Is it not on? It is. Okay. This is week number 7. But we're finishing up a little bit from week number 6. Actually, 7 is a little bit shorter. The material turned out that way, so this is, we shouldn't have any problem doing this in the 2 hours. But as I was saying, the Anabaptist radicals in Luther's day and Calvin's day, meaning 16th century, were more like charismatics today than Baptists. Now, there are some things in common, but if you look at like conservative Baptists, Southern Baptists, they all come out of the English Baptist movement, which in turn really came out of the magisterial reformation. And so, difference of government and baptism, but really, if you look like at the London Confession and those different confessions, there they are, the Westminster Confession, slightly modified. So a very different tradition than the crazy tradition of Thomas Munster, because he was one of the extremes in that movement. But good to keep that historically straight as we think about our Baptist brethren. Okay, the sacraments are very important for leaders as part of our pastoral care. And here I think we've tended to overreact to the Roman Catholic view of the sacraments. We will argue until the cows come in at night over the mode of baptism. But what the really significant thing we fail to think about, and that is the meaning of baptism and its significance for us. It's an objective sign and seal of God's grace, and He has given that to us, and we ought to use that to encourage our baptized members. We ought to use it to exhort young people. You are signified and sealed. You are marked out by God. You need to make that reality in public profession. You need to repent and believe the gospel and bring to fruition your baptism. We can even use it for evangelism with Roman Catholics if they've been baptized into the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Even though they're baptized by a priest, baptism does not depend on the efficacy or the state of heart of the man baptizing. The same with the Lord's Supper. Roman Catholics have always understood that, and here's a place where the Reformed, I think, have always understood this, but most modern Christians do not. There's a kind of objectivity to the sacrament which no one can corrupt as long as the basic elements of that sacrament are present, and that goes to the Lord's Supper or baptism. Interestingly, baptism was accepted by the Reformers almost to a man, Roman Catholic baptism, as being valid, even if not done always properly. In other words, not done in the most perfect or pure way, but still valid. Whereas the Lord's Supper was not valid because it was so corrupted that it was beyond recognition as the Lord's table. And we, of course, when it comes to the Lord's Supper, the pastoral care there is probably most obvious. It becomes a means of, in a sense, of our monitoring God's people. If we see someone not take the Lord's Supper, an elder should note that. Those that are serving the supper should note that. And that person should be immediately gone to and asked, what's going on in your life that you didn't take the Lord's Supper? How can we help you? And that has always traditionally been a wonderful sort of monitor for spiritual health. And also, it's a source of spiritual health because if understood and taken properly, the grace of God is being pictured and sealed to us. As we eat and drink, the Lord wants us to know that each one of His sheep partaking are indeed His people. Signified is really what the most Baptists and evangelicals today, they believe that the sacraments are a sign of the covenant of grace. They wouldn't define it that way, but that's basically what it is. It's a pure remembrance of something that happened in the past. We want to go one step further and say that it's also a seal. In other words, the living Christ in the sacrament actually brings a sealing or an assuring presence through his word to the sacrament. And that is very important in our using this as a means of pastoral care. And one of the things that's interesting, I have to share this with you, a little personal note. Last evening, as we lectured on Luther, and I made a point of showing how the church was such a majestic institution in Luther's day. Now, we know how that was abused, but as Protestants, I think we tend to underestimate the majesty of the church as an institution. We just think of it as just like any other democratic institution that we have. We've got our vote, our opinion's as good as anyone's, and the church is just a bunch of believers. And after making those points, Robin, when we came home, we went and sat in the study and chatted for a while, and she said, "Boy," she said, "we need to hear that more often, because we really have a terribly low view of the church." Some of it's a reaction to Roman Catholicism, which exalts the church almost above God. That's a problem. But we need to remember that perversion came out of a very high view of the institution, which is biblical. And we don't want to throw the proverbial baby out with the bathwater. So we should have a high view. And having a high view of the sacraments and the church, they go right together. If you have a low view of either of them, you'll have a low view of the other as well. We want to be careful, I think, to walk a fine line between the almost materialistic objective view or sacerdotal view of Roman Catholicism, which equates the actual element of baptism of the Lord's Supper with the thing that signified that I think we want to be careful of. On the other side, I think evangelicalism has basically evacuated the elements of all of their meaning and significance, and we want to be careful of that as well. Now, though it is proper for a minister of the gospel who is ordained to preach the whole counsel of God, nothing more and nothing less, it is still valid if someone who has perverted that office administers the sacrament. And here's something that just may rub you the wrong way, so I want to take a moment to talk about it. And there's been always a debate in our circles, and I think a healthy debate, though I think we should have settled it by now, but as to whether or not Roman Catholic baptism is valid. And if someone comes to us who's been converted, they were baptized in the Roman Church as infants, what do we do? Well, I've thought through this issue. I've got a file that's an inch thick that you can read anytime you want. It's got Calvin, it's got Hodge, it's got Thornwell, it's got the whole debate. And if you take an objective view of the sacrament, you protect it against the corruption of institutions. What do I mean by that? Well, we ought to, first of all, the fact that the Reformers accepted baptism in the Roman Church and rejected the Mass ought to tell us something. They thought through this issue very, very carefully and far more profoundly than I think most modern theologians and pastors and sessions are capable, really, of doing. But their reasoning went like this, and this is Calvin especially. He basically said, if we add anything subjective or variable to our definition of validity, we will all doubt our baptism. I'm not talking about the Lord's Supper, just baptism. We will doubt our baptism. Okay? So, was the priest a believer or not? Well, we would say probably most of those priests weren't believers, and we don't really know that, of course, but what about your Protestant minister who baptized you? What if he rejects the faith 20 years after your baptism? Does that make your baptism invalid? I hope not, because as Calvin says, baptism is God's institution. And look at the northern tribes of Israel. One of the ways that the prophets, in their deepest rebellion, appealed to them was the fact that they were circumcised, but they were behaving like uncircumcised people. It didn't say that their baptism was, their circumcision was invalid, but they were apostatized. They had gone off and worshipped in the wrong place. They were idolaters. Their baptism, their circumcision was still valid. Not proper, but valid. And that's a distinction that I think we need to make. And so the objective criteria were these, that if it was done with water, and I know that there's a little oil with the chrism that's mixed in, but they knew about that too. Believe me, they knew, because they used to administer it before they became real believers. But that was not enough to corrupt it. In other words, it's essentially water. It's like the question of the wine and the grape juice. It's essentially the fruit of the vine, and that's what really counts in terms of validity. Not to say it's proper, but it's valid, because water is present, and it's done in the name of the Trinity. It's not done as some liberal Dutch minister did it in Love, Peace, and Joy or something back in the 50s or 60s. That would not be valid. Then it's totally disconnected from the covenant of grace and from the God of that covenant. And if it's done with the intention of baptizing into the visible church, and certainly that was what the Roman Catholic Church was doing and what it does today, even though we, again, would not think that a proper church, it's an apostate church, but nonetheless, the baptism itself is valid. And Hodge basically took the same line of argument against Thornwell, and Thornwell was a brilliant theologian, and I like his thinking on most everything else, but he lost that debate, as far as I'm concerned, reading it through, because if you take the more subjective criteria, then we will end up doubting our own baptisms, even when they are done not only validly, but properly in a true church with all the marks of the church. Import one of those more subjective elements in, and you're going to undermine the objective foundation of the covenant sign and seal. So, in our session, when people come to me and they say, "But Pastor, I was baptized in the Roman Catholic Church, and we know that's apostate, and I don't feel baptized," I'm going to explain to them that your feelings about baptism, as important as they may be, are not the bottom line in our consideration of the covenant and of their relationship to its sacraments. And so I've had to deal with this. I have someone who feels very badly about me to this very day because I would not re-baptize them. But that's my conscience would not let me do that. And so they still don't feel baptized, even though they were when they were infants. And I feel badly about that. But it's one subject I've looked at with a great deal of care and come to a conclusion that I'm not very movable on. Jim? No, I think that it is, it's an apostate church. I would say that it is a church that is beyond the pale. The marks of the church are gone. And some could argue that in the Reformers' day, because it still was the church in a sense, that you come out differently on this validity question. But I think that there's a difference. See, I would want to make a difference, and a lot of Christians fail to make this distinction between an apostate church and a cult, or one of those other brands of a perverted Christianity. There's a difference, because what happens, how can I say this? You know, it's sort of like a Burger King franchisee, and they may change some things because they're a franchisee and not an actual corporate branch. They may change some things, but it's still Burger King. They still broil the things the same. They may change the way the seating plan, some of the logos or the looks of it or whatever, but it's still essentially the same. That's really not a great illustration, but yeah. That's right. Well, that's right. I mean, that's they, but they think that's the only church, see? And we understand that that's wrong. Yeah. Yes. That's what their intention is. That's right. See, and what there, it's not intention, doesn't mean to put the focus on the person's heart, the priest's heart. It's just it's the nature of the objective ministry of the church. That's what it is. In other words, it's part of an ordained ministry in a church that considers itself to be not only the part of the visible church, but the visible church. We understand that it's an apostate church, but we also understand that they have that one sacrament essentially right in the sense that it is objectively present. All their theology about it is tremendously mixed up. But what's interesting is that in the Mass, that theology so corrupts the administration of the Lord's Supper that it's no longer recognizable as the biblical institution. So it's not valid any longer. Whereas with baptism, it's just in a different category. George?
Can baptism be true?
Again, the minute you import a subjective criterion, the state of someone's heart, which no one can know, really, except God, you're dead in the water, George, because what it does is it undermines the objective character of the sacrament. So see, in the church here, let's say we baptize and the two parents become apostate 5 years later. Well, they come in by visible profession. And so we're looking at it in a sense from the outside. But yes, and of course again the valid and proper, there's maybe a huge gap between those two. It's not proper to baptize infants into the covenant of grace without believing parents, but it is objectively valid. And if you read Calvin, you'll see that he has no interest in compromising with the Roman Catholic Church. These guys are willing to risk their life for their stand on the Bible alone. But as part of that stand, they realized that if they were to import a subjective criterion, they would just undermine the institution. And as he said, it's not Rome's institution, baptism. It's God's institution. And even where it takes place in an apostate church, if it's done with those objective criteria, we need to accept it as valid. Yes. Yeah, exactly. As long as there's certain basic elements, they've made public promises, and there may be all kinds of other things we don't like about it. Right, but I think that what Jim is saying is that this is the question of validity. It's a good illustration of validity. Exactly. But we still recognize it objectively. Yeah. Oh, exactly. And they may be, the worst thing that can happen is that they get married by a justice of the peace in the middle of the night and they run off and call their parents from Las Vegas or something. But is it valid? Yes. Would we be pleased with it? No. It's not proper. It's highly improper. Excellent illustration, Jim. I think Al had a question, and then Jason, and then Peter. This is like Dunkin' Donuts. Would you like a number one or a number two?
How about the Campbellite Church of Christ that believes that baptism is regeneration?
Oh, baptismal regeneration?
Right. Both parents believe that they lose their salvation and then repent and get rebaptized over and over and over.
Yeah, well, we would all, I'd have to think about that one, Al, because I'd have to look at the way that they actually administer the sacrament. But remember, their belief about its efficacy is not the issue, because Rome has some very faulty beliefs about the efficacy of baptism. It clears your sins up to that point, and then you have to deal through the sacraments of the church the other sacraments, especially the Mass and Penance, that will sort of keep you clean up until the point of death, at least basically clean, and then you see what your credits are at the end of your life and how much time you have to spend in purgatory. You know, all that is faulty, and it's connected with baptism, a bad theology of baptism, but it doesn't undercut the validity. So if it's done in the name of the Trinity, and done with water, and done with the intention...
They do that.
Okay.
In the name of the Trinity, and they believe in the Virgin.
And I think, you know, we would, as a session...
But they believe that a non-minister can baptize. Anybody can baptize.
Okay. See, I knew there was something about those Campbellites because we had
a
guy.
They made a declaration. They could immediately get on the body of water, just a couple of minutes.
And just do it. Yeah, that would be a real problem because that's where that third criterion means that it's got to be an officer of the church that considers themselves to be qualified to administer the sacrament, even if we have all kinds of problems with their qualification. But that view, I think, would. That would threaten that third criterion, and I think, therefore, just on the face of it, I'm not going to commit myself to this position because we do have Campbellite churches around here. We might have to consider this at some point, but I would say that I'm going to be heading down the, we need to baptize you for the first time because that one is not valid. That's based on that third point.
The man I worked with here is the whole family was called Campbellite, and they avoided
Yeah, and they are radically against the Reformed faith and against the confession, for example. They believe that human confessions are absolutely forbidden. Huh. Well, hey, it makes it a lot easier. 3/4 of the Bible is the Old Testament. Okay, Jason, and then Peter. Well, yeah, the visible church is the church that bears the marks of the church, and we would count them as not part of the visible church any longer in that they are apostates. But being apostate is different than being a cult, which was built originally on the wrong foundation. There's nothing that we can identify with in the Jehovah's Witnesses. But in the Roman Catholic Church, it's different because they started out in the ancient church being the true church. And then slowly over time, as their corruption in their form of government, the centrality of Rome, the Pope, and all of that began to build up an accretion of stuff that covered over the truth. And so at what point did it not become the visible church? I think during the 16th century. Yes. That's right. But the notai is also not so narrow that, you know, we're doing the thing like some denominations do to say, well, only OPC churches are the true church. In fact, that's more of a cultic attitude. So the notai are a nice objective criteria. Doesn't mean it's always easy to discern because some churches are all churches are, in a sense, in a process. They're always growing and changing. And sometimes they're degenerating. At what point they actually cease being a true church, very difficult to tell. Peter, you were a Roman Catholic, so you have some inside information. Yes. That's right. No, I think that's it's a very similar question, and the point is, it's just like, you know, we wrestle with this in every part of theology in a way, and I think the Puritans had a wonderful balance when it came just generally to the Christian life between appreciating the objective realities of the covenant, the finished work of Christ, the character of God, the institutions of the church, the means of grace. These are objective. They're outside of us. And then looking on the other hand at the state of one's own heart and disposition. We never want to set those two against one another, but what we do want to do is protect the distinction. And especially when it comes to the sacraments, it's important to protect the distinction, because you'll always have people, the Roman Catholic looks on the objective almost exclusively, and it almost then degenerates to almost a materialistic kind of thing, where as long as you're a member, hey, you're saved, a formalism or a nominalism. Whereas on the other hand, a lot in Protestantism, maybe the Quakers would be the quintessential example of pure subjectivism. You sit in a room until you're moved. You know, there's nothing objective, no sacraments, no word. It all comes. It's all mediated through the human soul and its state. And that's to me, perhaps even more frightening than the Roman formalism, frankly.
Wouldn't that be a good argument?
Mm-hmm. Oh yes, and that's right, and that's why when we talk about baptism, we want to say that number one, it's only done once. It's very important, but it's not so important that you can't be saved without it. I love the way the confession says that, because, you know, it doesn't say, well, it's not so important, so don't worry about it if you're not baptized, you know. It says, no, this is a command of Christ to be baptized, and we as the church, it's part of the essential definition of evangelism and spreading the gospel. But it's not so necessary that one cannot be saved without it. So, yeah, that's exactly, we want to hold to that balance so that Robinson Crusoe, for example, nobody there to baptize him. Was he saved? Sure looks like it from what Daniel Defoe wrote about his conversion.
When I brought up to this church site person, and said, how about these people on the cross? You can imagine. How about the person who was in the iron lung that received Christ as their Savior and then died shortly after? Obviously, they cannot be converted.
Yeah.
They cannot be the other person on their deathbed. They had absolutely no answer.
Yeah. No, it doesn't surprise me.
It's so essential to that. It has to be immersed.
Yeah, that's baptismal regeneration.
And where does the baptism of the dead fit?
We haven't done that for several years, Peter.
Paul talked about the baptism of the dead. And this is
interesting you should mention that. That's why one of my favorites. Jason already knows this because he sat in on my course on biblical Bible tools, Bible study tools. But that's one of the few really difficult texts that I've actually come up with an answer that I'm satisfied with. And it was through doing a word study, and I actually walked the class through that whole. That's on tape, I think. I think somebody taped that. But anyway. Baptism for the dead actually doesn't refer to some odd new thing that suddenly pops up out of nowhere, but baptism means washing, and it doesn't mean immersion, by the way. It means washing, and there are various modes of washing. There's dipping, there's sprinkling, there's bathing, there's dunking, all kinds of different modes, but it means washing. And if you remember in the Old Testament, dead bodies, you had to be washed, go through a rite of washing or cleansing or baptism. And in fact, Hebrews 9:10 refers to the various washings of the Old Testament, one of which was for the dead. If you had contact with a dead body, you went to the temple, you had this rite administered to you. That's baptism for the dead. Not being, in other words, no one's being baptized for the dead, but being baptized because of contact with the dead. And that's really what that is. That, to me, seems like a very clear answer to that. And exactly, that context. So. That's right. And I think at worst, what we do with a text like that is we say, since it's unique, and there's no other, you know, after we've tested it to see if we there's other scriptures that speak to this issue, we just have to say, we don't know, but we're not going to start baptizing people in place of the dead because we're not sure. It's very unclear. So. Yep. Yeah. Well, see, one of the noti, though, the only problem with that argument is that one of the noti, the marks, is the proper administration of the sacraments, and that's where the reformers would say that there was enough of baptism to make it valid, and so there was some, in some sense, it was proper, whereas everything else was gone awry, the discipline, the word, and the Lord's Supper. So that's the one mark. So you know what it would be like, Jim? It would be like the, let's say the roof collapsed when it got so watery in here that everything just collapsed. And two of the stone stained glass windows were destroyed. But this one over here on Hazel Street was still there. Still good. It's still, the church, it's collapsed. It's a ruined church. But one window in it is completely intact and therefore can be reused. So it doesn't do much good by itself, honestly, but it is still, it's God's objective sign and seal of the covenant. If we need to move on at this point, but if anyone wants to read more on this, please let me know, because I have, as I said, I literally an inch thick file full of this stuff, because, you know, it's been years since I've read it, and he does, it's definitely in the Institute. There also, though, I think there are other, I know I had other quotes from the commentaries. And also, I think, perhaps, from his treatise on the church. You know, there's a thing by Baker, 7 volumes of letters is 4 volumes, and then there's 3 volumes of tracts and treatises. Excellent material, by the way. If you don't have that, look for it. It must be out there on the web somewhere if you want to get a poorly bound copy. You have to staple it together. Oh, okay, yes. That little Outlines of Theology, I'll tell you, A.A. Hodge has gone up over the years steadily in my estimation. Charles, of course, is the great systematician, his dad, and Addison was the brilliant linguist. I mean, the man was a genius. He was very unique. But A.A. sometimes gets so short. He is really was a very, very capable theologian. And yes, look at the sacraments and his coverage there in the outline. Also, though, I think that Hodge deals with this question in his book, The Polity of the Church, which has long been out of print. I have a copy of it, but I can get copies of all that material if you're interested. Okay, we need to move along. Baptism, definition, purpose, and proper administration. We've talked about that to some degree. We should think of baptism as the sacrament of initiation. It marks one's entrance into the church, either as an infant or as one who repents and believes as an adult. It's initiation. It's once, therefore, in the Christian life. The Lord's Supper is the sacrament of sustenance, and it happens continually throughout the Christian life, meant to nourish the initiated believer. Now, the mode and the subjects are the two areas of great controversy, and And these, of course, are very, very important. I think the question as far as the mode goes, we can't even begin to really get into this in great detail here. It's just not the context to do it in. But the sprinkling, I've actually concluded that sprinkling is the proper biblical mode. And I'm not going to get feisty about it because, to me, the mode is not the most essential part of it, but it is important. And if you look in the Old Testament, what you find is that those of those various baptisms, and there the word for baptizo is used, actually it's the noun form, in Hebrews 9:10. That's a very crucial text for on this question of mode, because what you have is you have a reference to all of the washings of the Old Testament. And what were they? They were all sprinkling. Only one of them was an actual dipping, and that had to do with the birds. And I forget the name of that. It's escaping me right now, but the name of that particular ceremonial rite. But remember, one bird is killed and dipped, and the other one is allowed to fly away, and it represents our redemption. But that's the only place where there's any suggestion of immersion. So the word baptized, I think, honest scholarship will admit plainly that it only may mean total immersion. It does not require it. Cleansing is the point. And see, the reason I think that's important for us to hold to that is that that's also the spiritual point of baptism, to show here the cleansing work of the Spirit. It's not meant, incidentally, to demonstrate or recreate resurrection. Think about this. When we talk about the identity, certainly it identifies us with the crucified and resurrected Christ. But the idea somehow that going down into the water and coming up out of the water, based on Romans 6, is really doesn't hold, no pun intended, water. Because what you have is you have a Christ whose body was laid into a tomb. It wasn't buried underneath anything. The stone was rolled away. It was a very different thing than what we're used to. We're imposing our Western burial rites on the ancient Near East. It was put into a side of a tomb, a dry tomb. And when he rose, we don't know what happened. We don't know whether he went through the roof of the tomb or simply walked through the stone door and then or rolled it open and walked out. We just don't know. And I think the point is not to deny the death and resurrection of Christ, certainly, but to show that the symbolism is a symbolism of cleansing, which unites us with the crucified and risen Christ, his blood. And therefore, we are certainly united to his death and resurrection. And we're to walk in newness of life, and we're to put off the grave clothes of the old life by God's the power of his word and spirit. But the mode, I think there are just a whole number of reasons why the mode is not to be accepted as immersion. And, however, I don't want to fall into the trap of making the mode so prominent that we lose track of the significance and the power of the sacrament itself. One other thing I might just bring up, and I was early on challenged as a very young Christian about or tending to be a Presbyterian. I wasn't fully committed at that point. But having come back from LaBrie, I was meeting with someone who was a very strong Baptist, and they brought me to Acts chapter 8, the Ethiopian eunuch. And the amazing thing about that is that the eunuch is reading from the servant song in Isaiah 52 and 3, and right before verses 5 and 6 of chapter 53, if you go back, it says that he will come and sprinkle all nations, which I thought was amazing. I mean, he's reading this. Philip comes to him, explains the gospel. He explains Jesus as the suffering Messiah. And then, where does that question come from? Well, let's get back. What's to hinder me from being baptized? What does he do? He goes down into the water. Both Philip and the eunuch. And I, as a dumb Christian, I mean, I was a young and very dumb. I did not know much theology at all back then. And I just looked at the text, and I said to this dear woman who thought this was going to convince me for sure, she said, look, it says down into the water. I said, that's simple. It means he walked down the banking, and they both stood in the water. When have you ever seen a Baptist minister immerse himself with his baptizee? Never. That language cannot mean that he went down under the water. It simply cannot. And that convinced me even more of my position. She was sort of dismayed because she didn't have an answer to that question. And it's not meant to be a humorous jab at the Baptist position, because I have the greatest respect for those who are truly believers who are Baptists. I just think that this doctrine is not doesn't hold up under the evidence of the New Testament. But that's just the mode. I think the most significant dimension of the question is the subject of baptism. And that, of course, has to do with who is baptized. Now, this was the toughest one for me. The mode question, just because I've always been interested in words, all I had to do was study the nature of the word baptismo and look it up in a few lexicons and read a few good books. And then look at, even in the English, some of those challenges like the one I just mentioned with the Ethiopian eunuch. And I was convinced of the Presbyterian position. The subjects is a very different thing. Baptizing babies, boy, that seems so much like a Roman Catholic Church, like a kind of dead formalism. How can they possibly be baptized if they don't believe? And I think it was when I really began to look at what Peter was saying honestly in Acts 2 at Pentecost and realized that I had to deal with the consciousness of the covenant that undergirded, that was assumed by what he said at the end of his sermon. That's what really bothered me. And that's what began to unsettle me as a Baptist. And I began to look at that and say, if he was going to exclude what had to have been, I mean, there were 3,000 baptized on that day, and they all came. I mean, it's just a known fact that the whole family came up to celebrate the Feast of Ingathering on the day of Pentecost. There were babies there, and there were probably lots of babies and little children of all ages. And he says, the promises to you and your children. And I said, you know, if he's going to take that away from them, he would have had to have said something. Because these Jews had 2,000 years or more of that consciousness of the covenant, including their families, ingrained in their souls, and all the way back to Abraham. And so I began to be troubled by that. Then, as I thought about the household baptisms, that's presumptive evidence in the sense that it doesn't say it baptized infants, but it reminds you of Abraham. It reminds you of the promise to Abraham that through his seed he would bless the nations of the earth, the families of the earth among the nations. And so dealing with families, running very much against our very individualistic grain. And I think that infant baptism is in a way it's a strengthener of our view of the family as a unit before God. I think it's a very important feature also of the nurture of our children. But as I looked at that, then I realized that the great challenge of the Baptist, and I think it's an earnest challenge because it's based on clear biblical texts of believe and be baptized, okay? Peter even says that on the day of Pentecost. Then I went back, and let me just walk you through this quickly. Romans 4. I'm reading through Romans 4. And I come to verse 11. And it's talking about Abraham, proving that this doctrine of justification by faith is the original way of the covenant, going all the way back to this most fundamental covenant administration with Abraham. And he says, and he received the sign of circumcision, a seal of the righteousness of the faith which he had while still uncircumcised, that he might be the father of all those who believe. Now, wait a minute. This says that, and incidentally, this is where the sign and seal language of the confession comes from, right from this text. It's a sign and seal of the righteousness of the faith of Abraham. But it's clear that that same sign and seal of faith, the righteousness that comes by faith, is given to children who do not have faith, as far as we can tell. So I realized suddenly that if I had a problem with the Lord administering the sign and seal of the covenant to an infant who didn't have faith and who couldn't exercise it yet, that I had a problem not with Presbyterians, but with the way God did things in the Old Covenant. Now, the way that the Baptist will get away from that question, the way that you have to, and I think that this is, it's legitimate in as far as it goes, is that they want to then distance themselves so much from the Old Covenant, make such a disjunction between the Old and the New, that there's really no relationship between circumcision and baptism. The problem is that the way you can do that, if you do it, you've got to do it with texts that refer to the Mosaic Covenant. See? But in fact, what Paul is hearkening back to and the initiation of circumcision was the Abrahamic Covenant. And Abraham becomes, in a way, the Old Testament prototype of the New Testament believer. He does it here, he does it in Galatians, and I don't think you want to, for many other reasons, undermine the essential unity of the covenants. But that's what you have to do in your thinking in order to escape the logic of, if it was good enough for God doing it to Abraham, why not in the new covenant? Now, of course, there are many things that we don't want to reproduce from the Abrahamic period, mainly that Jesus has come, and for Abraham, he...